One of the biggest risks that I'm seeing right now, which has probably been the case for the last 3 years, I see so many losses for banks stemming from a business email compromise.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Lindsay Hughley, and joining me today is Shelley Clarkson. Shelley advises banks on regulatory compliance, cybersecurity, and technology risk. She helps banks design and implement compliant, secure operations aligned with federal and state expectations, including GLBA, FFIEC, and agency guidance from the FDIC and the OCC. Shelley regularly counsels clients on privacy and cybersecurity compliance, including NIST and CISA frameworks, incident response planning, vendor risk management, and a cloud and AI contracting. She drafts and negotiates data processing agreements, information security provisions, and technology contracts to mitigate risk while enabling innovations. Her work integrates regulatory, transactional, and cybersecurity considerations, allowing her to serve as a strategic advisor to financial institutions navigating rapidly evolving technology and data security challenges. Welcome, Shelley.
Thank you. Sorry, that was a mouthful.
I always feel like IT-related, especially intros, people that are very deep in it, it is a lot more wordy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
definitely. It does always feel like a different language when you are bringing up IT. But to start off with here at Banking Matters, before we dive into our topic, we do always like to hear how our guests got started working with financial institutions.
All right. So I started... not to give away my age, although I'm older than most people say I look. But long time ago, my first job was at a bank right after I turned 16. And so I worked for a community bank all through high school, and then all through college. And then after college, I managed a branch of a very large financial institution while I also got my master's degree. So by that time, I had been in banking for between 10 and 15 years before I even went to law school. And then I went to law school, and again, that was still a long time ago. After law school, I counseled banks in private practice and then ended up going in-house and being general counsel for a bank. And so I've been in banking over 20 years at this point in various roles. I've been in the bank, I've been on the loan side, the operation side, the compliance side, been legal counsel, I've worked for technology platforms that work with banks, and now, you know, at the law firm. So lots of roles and lots of experience.
Yeah, and honestly, what a great diverse lens to look at everything from, especially when dealing with cybersecurity, for sure. I'm sure that definitely benefits you as well.
It does. And one of the things that my clients like about working with me is I know what it's like to be on the banker's side. You know, it's so easy for an attorney to, you know, sit here and say, well, your policy needs to do that, say this, or you need to do this. Okay, well, maybe that's true. But what is it actually going to be like when you implement that at the bank? Sometimes that's very different. And so I think I'm really good at really closing that gap and kind of identifying, you know, things from all perspectives.
So. Absolutely. So today, as we jump straight into talking about cybersecurity, what would you say are some of the biggest cybersecurity risks that you're currently seeing?
Yeah, so one of the biggest risks that I'm seeing right now, which is probably been the case for the last 3 years, I see so many losses for banks stemming from a business email compromise. And for those that may not know what that is, most people probably do, but what that is that somehow, usually it's a credentials, you know, there's a breach of credentials, you provide your credentials unintentionally, maybe through a phishing attack or something, and a fraudster gains access to your email account. They could use your actual email account or create a new email account that looks so similar to the legitimate one that someone doesn't recognize it. And so what's happening is that these fraudsters, after a business email compromise, and oftentimes it's on the side of the bank customer. And these bank customers, they're then, you know, getting, or it could be credentials, access, you know, credentials to online banking, and they're generating transactions. It could be wire transfers. That's really common. But I've also seen this happening with ACH transactions too. So any sort of electric payments, it can apply to. And so they're initiating these transactions, and then the bank, you know, they're used to maybe receiving emails from this particular person at this particular institution. Everything looks normal, and they send the wire out. Well, come to find out later that their email was compromised and the bank had no idea. That happens so much, not only between the bank and the bank customer, but also between private parties. And then the banks are getting drug in. You know, everyone always assumes, well, you know, the bank is the most sophisticated party. They should have known this. Well, maybe not, you know? And so that is such a huge issue, this business email compromise or access to credentials.
And so how can banks go about balancing the speed to market for these new digital products with like cybersecurity and compliance?
Yeah, so having worked at the bank and many banks and being on the compliance side, the compliance people get a bad rap, right? You've got the, you know, the people, the board or whomever, that there's this awesome new product and they want to launch it. And you have the compliance people that, you know, they see them as like the fun killers, right? Like, hold on, let's pump the brakes and, you know, make sure we're compliant. Well, it shouldn't be that way. You know, there really should be, compliance should be part of that new implementation of the digital product. It should be built in. And so ways that banks can do that is to have their list of controls, and they probably already have controls in place, the bank does, for, you know, information security, cybersecurity, or whatever. Also, it depending on what the product is, say it's a lending product, there are going to be some controls there. So making that implementation and the compliance process integrated, so it's not, you know, design a little bit and then we run it through compliance, design a little bit and then we run it through compliance, but rather the design that's in the controls built in together so that you can quickly move through that process. And then also, and I try to live my life like this, this became a lot easier once I had a daughter or a child, it doesn't have to be a girl, but pick your battles, right? You sometimes, if it's a low risk and it's, you know, there's not a lot of risk that there's going to be a financial loss, just let it go and focus on the higher risk items or the risks with, you know, that implementation or the product or whatever that may not result or have a high risk of loss.
Absolutely. And I can say I've been in compliance for the last several years, and now with the different banks that I do get to work with, having that discernment on what really is the actual risk that we are exposed to? Is it worth all of that extra time to mitigate that risk? Because sometimes banks, and that's one thing that I feel like compliance people can sometimes get caught up in, is that the time and effort and all of that that it takes to mitigate that risk really isn't worth the weight or of the mitigation in itself, because the risk is so low to begin with.
I think that to be in banking compliance, I think a lot of us are kind of type A, right? We like everything to be perfect, and you know, and that's hard. That is really hard. I think it's a skill, honestly, like learning how to just let some things go. It takes practice.
Yes, absolutely. And so in kind of segueing off of that, when you are trying to discern and weigh that out in regards to risk, what does reasonable security actually look like for a community bank, especially versus a large regional bank?
Yeah. So as with pretty much anything applicable to any financial institution, you know, regulators expect your policies, procedures, controls to be based on the size and complexity of the institution. And so the actual framework that exists. So, you know, for example, every institution needs to have an incident response plan and, you know, information controls and all of those. Those expectations are there, regardless of the institution. But where the difference comes in is the depth of those. So, you know, there could be, you know, with a small institution, maybe you've got 10 employees. So you're not going to have a cybersecurity team. And so making sure that you're meeting the requirements, but then maybe adjusting the depth with which those requirements go based on, again, the size and complexity of the bank.
Perfect. And so also when you're, and I completely understand that banks are so different in pretty much every aspect. It really is hard to find two that are running on the same page. And so just in general, when you are considering compliance's involvement in cybersecurity governments, what does that look like for compliance versus IT and security teams?
Yeah, so the way I see it, we kind of have three different teams. Now, I'm using that term team loosely for an institution that could be one person, but you know, I see the cybersecurity team as one bucket. Then you have your IT as another bucket, and then your compliance team as the third. And again, those can be one person, although your compliance person should be different than your cybersecurity and IT person, because the cybersecurity team, they're the ones that are designing the controls, implementing the controls based on the particular cybersecurity risks of the bank. And then you've got your IT team, and they are really responsible for, you know, the infrastructure itself and administration of those systems. And then you have your compliance team, and then they're responsible for making sure, okay, well, we have these controls. Are we complying with them, right? And so we've really got three different roles, but they all should work together, because if there is some compliance issue, you know, they're obviously going to need to work with the cybersecurity team to remedy that, and maybe IT, depending on what the compliance issue is. If it's, you know, a data environment or something, IT is going to need to be involved. So, you know, making sure that you've got those particular individuals and roles specified, but then again, working together to try to, you know, mitigate and resolve risks.
Absolutely. And I do love how you differentiated the fact that cybersecurity and IT are usually who are creating and implementing those controls. And then right. compliance is essentially verifying that they are there, that they're doing what they're supposed to, and that it is meeting the expectations that are required of them. So that does make a ton of sense to have those two kind of separate. And then also when banks are looking at third party and fintech, what risk, how are those risks different for banks when they're getting involved with them than they were 5 years ago?
Yeah. So, I've been in this space for a while and things have changed a lot. I think probably within the last few years, even regulators have kind of come down on banks a little hard for, you know, their fintech programs. They were, I would say, 5 years ago, but I think within the past few years, that's really increased. So let's say 5 years ago, I think at least in my experience, the focus was, okay, well, we have these contracts, you know, and our contracts specify, you know, all of these information security requirements. You have to have a SOC report and you know, all of these things. This is our contract. This is what you're required to comply with. And every year after we sign this contract, we're going to follow up with you and we're going to get your SOC report and we're going to look at it. Well, now I think things are much more involved. I've got some clients that have amazing fintech programs, you know, where a lot of banks are getting into trouble because they're really not doing it right. I've got some clients, they're great. And they're great because that oversight and working with that third party or the fintech is constant. It is not, you know, every 6 months or every year. And so I think the amount of oversight and integration between the two has changed a lot. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a lawyer. I love contracts. Like, you need good, solid contracts. I'm not saying that. But it's now, you know, that process doesn't just end after that contract is signed.
Absolutely. And I do know that we've had another guest on that has talked about the importance of, it was when we were talking about mergers and acquisitions. I know they're two different beasts, but he was like, always go back and read it two or three times so that you do have that intimate understanding of all that is involved. And honestly, when you think about if you are doing a super involved fintech agreement, that contract, it's basically like you're two working side by side and coming together to kind of produce something that can be, that is all for your customers. And so at the end of the day, it really is so important to have such good and clear understanding in your contract and to have someone that does fully understand all of that and that can speak to it. And I know examiners, from my experience, examiners want you to be able to communicate that contract clearly and to be fully aware of what's involved in it too, to add a little, I guess, confident. To me, it makes you sound confident when you are speaking to the examiner and you can explain that intimately.
Yeah, and I do think examiners, I mean, never has a financial institution been able to offload any of its responsibilities to a third party. But I think within the last few years, that has really been made more clear. And so all of your, you know, all of the CIP and, you know, your OFAC searches and all of that information, examiners are becoming far less patient is probably not the right word, but the expectation has really been made clear within the last few years that the bank cannot just push that responsibility onto the third party or the fintech.
Yes, absolutely. And so earlier you had mentioned incident responses. Yeah. So what are regulators expecting to see in those incident response plans? And what do you typically see that banks are missing?
Yeah, so the incident response plan, it needs to clearly outline what exactly is going to happen if there's an incident. You know, if there's a data breach, for example, or a ransomware attack or something like that. So the plan, it needs to specify its triggers. When is it applicable? It needs to specify all of the roles of the various parties and what you're to do. Now, all banks are required to have an incident response plan. And I don't know that I've come across a client that doesn't, but I think what banks are missing, even some of my clients who, you know, I think we work really well together and they're honestly, for the most part, doing an excellent job every day. People aren't testing their incident response plans. And so the best way to test a plan is to do a tabletop exercise. And that's where, you know, someone will come in. For example, a partner in my firm, Sean Tuma, you may know who he is. I think he did a podcast with you a couple years ago.
Yes, that's super familiar.
Yeah, he is an amazing cybersecurity expert, and I work with him a lot. But he is so great at doing these tabletops. And what he'll do, he'll go into a bank, for example, and there's a whole scenario where there is an incident, you know, and you're testing it in real life. And then you actually implement the plan. And so that is so much better than just sending the plan out for employees to read. It's way different, right? I mean, you can read something and yeah, I read it, I understand it, but actually like testing it out and you've tried it, right? Everything is better the second time you do it than the first time. And when you actually have an incident, the first time you're trying it out isn't, let's not make that the time that, you know, we're under attack here. And so I think that's what a lot are missing, is just that proper testing of those plans.
Absolutely. And that is such a good point. I know as a compliance officer, I've used that a lot. Once we've seen repeated deficiencies, if we've trained on it, if we've talked about it, if we've brushed up procedures and we are still having issues, the next thing we do is we're role playing it. We're doing situational things to try to find if there's a new root problem within the procedures or in the, I guess, the understanding of those procedures when they're coming over. And so I can definitely say that that is such a good idea. And I wonder how many people have actually thought to take that thought process and apply it to your incident response plan.
Right.
And so in your opinion, if a bank is to suffer a cyber incident tomorrow, what three decisions that they could make today would most affect the outcome?
So I would say first is designating your incident commander today and giving that person authority to take charge. I mean, what you want to designate someone who understands, who's been, you know, has been hopefully part of those tabletop exercises and who really has the authority, because you need one person to stand up and lead the team, right? They're the one who is making calls, contacting, depending on what the issue is, contacting legal counsel or the insurance company, designating a really great incident commander, and then again, giving them authority to act. And then second, I would say, making sure that all of your, say, backup systems or data backups are actually of value. So you may say, we're good. We have a backup system. Well, what if you can't access it? Or what if you have this backup data, but the data is no good, or it's in some format that you actually can't access? So actually going and looking at your backup data and your backup systems to make sure that they are actually of value prior to an incident is going to be crucial. And then the third, let's see, I took, I took some notes here. What did I say for the third one? Those first two are so, so huge. Oh, the third, yeah, we already talked about it, so I wasn't coming to mind. Do a tabletop exercise. That is just, like we talked about, such a great way to practice and identify potential gaps or issues that can be resolved prior to an actual incident.
Absolutely. Well, Shelly, as we wrap up here at Banking Matters, we do always like to ask our guests for one piece of advice that they would like to leave our listeners.
I think that my one piece of advice, it's going to be a boring contractual piece of advice, but with respect to, we have all these fraud losses happening, right? With wires, electronic payments. Make sure you have really good contracts. You should have a wire transfer agreement with your customers. And that wire transfer agreement really needs to specify your security procedures. And one of those should be dual control. A lot of customers, they don't like dual control. Cool. They may not like dual control, but that should be your default security procedure. And if the customer wants to waive that, cool. That's on the customer then. So making sure you've got that really great wire transfer agreement and dual control can be a lifesaver for the bank.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Shelly, so much for your time and your insight. And for the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters.